Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. Super excited to be joined by Jason Wild today. If you don't know who Jason is, you will soon, and I suggest that you do a little bit of research. He did a fantastic interview with Real Vision, and there's a couple other ones on YouTube. For a primer on the space that we're going to be talking about, you can listen to Aaron Edelheit's episode that dropped on April 20th. This is going to be a cannabis-focused interview, but I think on top of cannabis, Jason's a super interesting guest. So we'll have a little bit of a combination of money management plus some morphing into cannabis plus entrepreneurship. So it's going to be a fun one. So Jason, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Bill?
I'm good. Nice to see you. I was trying to think about how I can do a different interview with you without making you repeat the same story that everybody wants you to. But I do think it's a super fascinating sort of framing where you're coming from. If you could talk a little bit about how you started in investment management, that's a pretty cool story.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm originally a pharmacist. I grew up in New York, and my dad is a pharmacist as well. So I sort of grew up in his drugstores in New York City. I got my pharmacy license in 97. But in my last year or so in pharmacy school, I got into the stock market. I read the Peter Lynch books, One Up on Wall Street and Beating the Street, and it was all Buy What You Know. So I was all excited to go out and investigate some different drug companies and invest in some of them. I realized that I started investing that last year in pharmacy school, and I realized that I was a good stock picker. I you know, back in the day, it was Warner Lambert was launching a new drug, Lipitor. I thought that was going to do really well.
Good call.
Yeah. Thank you. So then I got my pharmacy license, and I was so excited. I was going to be making $65,000 a year. And amazingly, I only needed about half of that to live on. So I was taking every other paycheck that first year as a pharmacist, putting it in my Charles Schwab account, margining it 2-to-1 because I didn't know any better. And after that first year, I made $65,000 as a pharmacist, and I ended up making about $500,000 in the market investing in pharmaceutical stocks. And I was bored out of my mind filling prescriptions and loved the market. I was completely passionate about it. So I ended up, there was an ad in the back of Barron's that said, do you want to start your own mutual fund or hedge fund? I called the guy up. He ran one of these fund administration companies, and he gave me the whole scoop. It cost me $20,000 in legal fees. Got the fund up and running. My view was, if you build it, they will come. So I started it with $80,000 under management. I didn't really care what I started it with. I felt like as long as I had an audited track record for a long enough period of time, eventually we'd be able to raise money. And you know, that's how we started. And for the first 2 years, I actually moonlighted at, I don't know if they have them out by you, ShopRite is a big supermarket chain. I worked at the ShopRite pharmacy in Paramus, New Jersey, two nights a week, just to pay the bills because, you know, running $80,000 wasn't going to fully cut it, even though I didn't have the expenses that I have now. So did that for the first 12 years. We did only public equities, got the fund up to about $25 million under management by 2010. We were up like 23% a year net of fees. My real wheelhouse was what's called specialty pharma companies, which are the drug companies that are not the big cap guys like Merck and Pfizer and Abbott. And I really liked the ones that were doing M&A because I knew the products, and I knew when a company would announce a deal and they said, we're buying this company or product XYZ from this other company, I was able to pretty quickly in my head calculate how accretive it would be, whether it was a good product, whether it had good, you know, sustainable patent life, things like that. And I ended up around 07, I referred a deal between one company I knew and another company. I found this company a product that was available for sale, and they bought this product for $10 million, had a couple of things break their way, and over the next 5 years, they did over $150 million in earnings on this product. And I put that whole thing together. I found it. You know, they wouldn't have found it if I didn't sort of shake it loose. And what did I get? You know, I got a pat on the back. So that's what put the idea in my head.
You said, I got to make more money from this.
Right. Exactly. It's nice to be nice and, you know, the whole good karma and all that. But it made me realize that I, you know, sort of gave something pretty valuable away. So that's what put the idea in my head to start a drug company or to buy a very small one to use as a platform. I worked on recruiting a CEO for a couple of years, say between 08 and 2010. And then finally, it all came together. I found this great CEO, Ed Schutter. He partnered with me. We bought this little company called Arbor Pharmaceuticals for $2.5 million. They were doing like $1.5 million in sales. The products they had were nothing special, but it was a platform. They had their licenses in every state, and it was just, it would have helped get us up and running a little bit quicker. But it was really to go out and find some deals. And we ended up that first year, we got really lucky. We found three amazing deals, very accretive and structured so that we didn't have to raise a lot more equity. By the end of that year, we had those products in-house. And the next year, 2011, with those products in-house, we did $127 million in sales and $55 million in pre-tax profit.
Oh.
And then it grew from there. By 3 years later, we were doing over $100 million in pre-tax profit. And we sold a third of the company to KKR. And the cool thing was that they bought all secondary shares. So I was able to actually cash out my investors. Not, you know, usually you would have, they would just put money into the, they would be primary shares that would go into the company. But here it was actually, we were able to sell a third of our stake and my investors were able to sell a third of their stake to KKR. And it was at a $1.12 billion valuation. So it ended up coming out to, you know, 155 times the price that the per share that they originally invested at. And it really ballooned the size of my fund. You know, my fund going in was $25-ish million. Coming out, it was over $300 million. And we had like $140 million in cash from selling a third of our stake to KKR. And it just aligned well with, it was right around the time that I got a call from a banker up in Canada raising money for one of these new medical cannabis companies up there. I didn't know anything about, you know, legal cannabis up in Canada, but I do like to sort of get off my butt and leave the office and try to go meet with companies as much as I can, because I find that I always learn something, even if I don't find something to invest in. And I went up there, met with this company, Metrum, and they really sort of gave me the whole lowdown about cannabis in terms of all of these true medical uses for it. First time I ever heard of CBD, or that there were these, you know, all of these different cannabinoids. And I came out of that meeting sort of like on fire, that I needed to meet as many companies as I could in the space. I thought the Canadian companies were going to do really well because it was legal nationwide. It wasn't like the US where you had a conflict between state and federal law. And to be honest, I was worried that if at that point I wouldn't have been comfortable investing in the US because I was worried about getting arrested. But in Canada,
that's a fair worry, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of, it's funny, people laugh now and it's only, you know, 2021, but it was, even a couple of years ago, it wasn't so crazy.
Me out also. And I was always worried that they would like, you know, the federal government would come in and take all the cash of the state operators and stuff like that. I mean, I was never comfortable with Colorado's sovereignty in the beginning and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. And the issue with Colorado, I think, is you couldn't even be an out-of-state investor up until a couple of years ago.
Hmm.
But yes, I do know actually a couple of California companies that did have their cash seized.
Oh, really?
In like, you know, more towards like 2011 or 2012. Yeah.
I remember back in the day when they were driving basically Brinks trucks between, you know, it couldn't keep it in a bank. So I guess you had like an alternative banking relationship or whatever. It was all cash. They had to have armed guards. It was like, this is crazy.
It's a lot of cash. Still a ton of cash. I mean, that's definitely an issue. You know, now you can bank a little more, but it's still, even in California, there's a big presence of the credit unions are, you know, banking a lot of these cannabis companies because still a lot of the bigger banks won't do it. And it's just spotty. Some of them, they'll do it. Some of the bigger firms, they'll do it for you for 2 years and then they just decide that they don't want to do it anymore. Sort of like what's been happening or what the worries have been more recently over custody of, you know, of some of these stocks in the U.S. where some of the prime brokers are just sort of changing their minds. But anyway, you know, so I went after that Metrum visit. I just started doing trips to go up to Canada, sort of crisscrossing the country. You know, I would start in Vancouver, work my way to Toronto over about 5 days, meet with as many companies as I could. They were all private at the time. So we ended up investing mainly in about five companies those first couple of years, say, you know, 15 and 16. Fortunately, they became some of the more successful public companies. We were, you know, up until the end of 18, we were a top six or seven shareholder in Canopy Growth, top 10 in Kronos, big shareholder in Organigram and CanTrust and a couple of these other ones. And we invested in them all privately. It's interesting though, because they did not, most of them, we were not up a lot on the investment when they went public. We made most of our profits after they went public, you know, holding on to them as they had that big ramp up until legalization at the end of 18 in Canada. And then towards the end of 17, I was up at a conference in Canada. By that point, we had invested, you know, probably about $30 million in the space, and it was worth probably, in, you know, around $175 million. And that's when it sort of hit me that I had just followed the same arc with, or first part of the same arc with cannabis investing that I had done in pharmaceuticals, which was For those first 12 years, I invested only in non-control positions in pharma companies, learned the space, built a network, made some money, and my goal with Arbor was to bring all that to bear as the lead investor and the chairman, and you know, hopefully really be able to impact the results. And Arbor worked, you know, beyond my wildest dreams. But I realized I had just done the same part in cannabis. We'd been investing for three or four years, learned the space, you know, all non-controlled positions, learned the space, built a network, made some money. But in this industry, I felt like if we went out and started a company from scratch, that I felt pretty confident that we were going to be able to build a pretty substantial company, because the level of competition was just a lot lower than it is, in pharma. So that was my idea. It ended up manifesting itself through this investment in TerrAscend. I had invested $250,000 in TerrAscend in January 17. It was now November of 17. And they had about a $50 or $60 million market cap. By November, they were public. They had a facility up in Canada. They already had their license to grow, but the facility still, it was functional, but it still needed a lot more build out. And I convinced them to take a $52.5 million private placement into the company, which is what we did. It was around $1.10 a share. And I let Canopy Growth and Canopy Rivers, which is a sort of a VC arm of Canopy Growth, which we were, you know, the second largest shareholder in, I let them co-invest in that deal with me. So I did 60% of it for my fund, and they each did 20%, and I became the chairman. And I really pushed myself. By that point, my fund was around $700 million in AUM. I find that as funds get bigger, they diversify.
Yeah.
They start looking at positions, not from a percentage of the portfolio perspective, but just from a dollar perspective, and start taking less risk. And maybe part of it is because they're running a money management business and they don't want to screw up a good thing.
Yeah, it's a nice life.
Yeah, right, exactly. But I've always run my fund as more like my family office, and I want to have the best returns that I can. And I feel like if you're over diversified, it's a lot harder to swim against the market, you know, because you are the market.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. So when you, going back to when you turned the $80,000 into $500,000 or whatever, how many positions were you running?
Oh, I was very concentrated. probably three or four.
Wow. That's cool. But you had unique insight, right? So that's when you got to bet it.
And unique insight. And I think when it comes down to it, you can't teach people how to invest in stocks in business school. I mean, I'm saying that because I went to pharmacy school and I didn't go to business school, but certain people just have a good feel for the market and other people don't. And it's just the way they're psychologically built. Like most people are built that they hold their losers and they sell their winners, which, you know, Peter Lynch calls that, you know, pulling out the flowers to water the weeds.
Yeah.
For some reason, I'm hardwired that if I have a stock that keeps going up, and if the fundamentals, usually it's because the fundamentals were better than I originally thought that they were going to be, I have no problem buying more of that stock a lot higher than where I originally bought it. And alternatively, if I have a stock that's beating the hell out of me every single day, very often I'll just sell it just because I can't sort of take the pain and have to feel like I, you know, have to keep watching the stock that's hurting me every day. So that's sort of different than most people in terms of how they act. And a lot of it, I think, is subconscious. Most people just, they can't do it. If they have a stock that's going up a lot, they feel like they have to do something.
Yeah.
To me, I tell people, like, you should be worrying and thinking about whether you should do something if you have a stock that's going down a lot, not if it's going up. So my view is sort of most people, I think, don't make money in the market in individual stocks. And it's just because you have to be wired the right way to be able to make money and not have too much emotion about it, I guess.
This is the old losers average losers thing, right?
Right. I never heard that, but that's good.
Yeah. So, all right. So you get yourself into cannabis and you got the green light in your own head, if I remember this correctly, to invest in the U.S. cannabis when John Boehner went on a board, right?
Yes. So exactly. So we ended up December of 17 is when the TerrAscend deal closed and I became the chairman. For the first 6 months or so, I was still doing my whole only Canada thing. And that was like from, you know, 14 or 15 when we started, it was a conscious decision. A, you know, like I mentioned, I was worried about getting arrested, but B, I felt like it wasn't too much of a give because I felt like the Canadian companies were going to be the first companies to attract other institutional capital. And it was going to be like a lot of people trying to get through a small doorway and push up the value of these stocks. And that worked from 14 till around 18. So in terms of TerrAscend, for those first 6 months or so, we were still doing Canada only, and we were bidding on, we bid on a few deals, and we just kept getting outbid for everything because the other Canadian companies sort of had too much cash at that point. You know, they were able to raise money pretty easily, and they were just like, we would be bidding on something and the management team would really like us and think we were credible, but, and they would take less from us than from somebody else, but they wouldn't take like 70% less from us. They maybe did 25% less, right?
Yeah, there's a limit to how much liking somebody goes, right? At some point, money talks.
Right, exactly. So we ended up missing out on all these deals, and it was very frustrating. And then John Boehner, like you said, I think it was like April or so of 19, he announced he was going on the board of Acreage. And that was like, I was like, that's it. You know, nobody's getting arrested. You know, John Boehner's too powerful of a person. They'll go after him before they'll go after somebody else. And I just didn't think they were going to go after anybody. And so that is when we pivoted my fund and TerrAscend into the U.S., or at least to start looking at things in the U.S. Took a little while. We had to restructure Canopy Growth and Canopy River shares because they were on the TSX and Canopy was on the New York Stock Exchange at the time. And this would have gotten them kicked off if they owned a plant-touching business in the U.S.
Yeah.
So it took a little while. We came up with that exchangeable share structure where they exchanged their regular shares for new shares that were only monetizable upon federal permissibility in the U.S. That's what we ended up having a shareholder vote in November of 18. That all got restructured so that we can actually go and start buying some assets in the U.S. We actually, in summer of 18, we applied for a license in New Jersey because we were told that wouldn't get us offsides if we applied. It just would have, even before we got the Canopy shares were changed, we just obviously were not going to be able to operate it until all of that was cleaned up.
Oh, okay. So you can get the license approval, you just can't operate before it's cleaned up.
Right.
Okay. So it's almost like you can buy an option to operate, you just can't operate.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
That's right. So, and we didn't think we were going to win. I mean, they were only going to, you know, Jersey had 6 licenses, you know, fully vertically integrated already, and they were going to give out another 6. And they were, you know, going to be well over 100 applications, but we figured we'd give it a shot. It was, you know, next door, you know, I'm based in New York. So we applied and we ended up in December of 18, they announced the winner and we were the only company that swept all 3 regions of New Jersey. Jersey had split it up into North, Mid, and South, and they were giving out 2 licenses in each, and we had the top score in each region. But unfortunately, they only gave us 1 license. They gave us the Northern region, which is the best region.
That's close to New York, right?
I'm sorry?
That's close to New York, right?
Very easy access to New York.
Not a bad region.
It's the best. It's the best region in Jersey. It has the most people and an even bigger piece of the economy. So, and now New Jersey's coming online and it's going to be a huge driver for us. But it's been a long haul there and lots of problem solving along the way. But our first deal that we actually announced and bought in the U.S. was about 6 months later. In the beginning of 19, we announced that we were buying the Apothecarium dispensary chain in San Francisco, one of the nicest dispensary groups that I knew of. And when you talk to people in California and you bring up the Apothecarium, everybody's like, oh, wow, those are the nicest dispensaries. In Northern California, they've got a really nice market share in San Fran and just really, it was the first of the really nice dispensaries, I would say.
Yeah.
So we bought that in 19 and then we did a deal, which I would say is our best deal so far, which was the purchase of Ilera Healthcare in Pennsylvania. They were the number one cultivator and manufacturer in Pennsylvania, owned about 20-ish% of the market. And we did a deal to buy them for $125 to $225 million in total consideration. We structured it. I think one of the reasons I feel like I've been able to do relatively well in M&A is that I'm creative and I'm good at figuring out how to solve for both sides' needs. And in the case of Ilera, the sellers, like most mom and pops, the sellers wanted mostly cash, right? So we figured out a deal that got them about 90% cash. They just didn't get it all right away.
Yeah,
so they got
through earnouts and whatever.
Yeah, what it was we closed on that deal towards the end of the summer of 19. We gave them $25 million in cash and $25 million in stock up front, and then we owed them I think another $20 million the following January, but the major final and majority payment was due in March of 21, so just a couple of months ago. And it was calculated we were going to go look back at 2020 sales, multiply it by 3, essentially give them 3 times sales with a cap of $225 million, and only as long as their EBITDA margin was over 35%. And it ended up, you know, Ilero, we ended up doing a major or a few major expansions there. And they blew way past, you know, the $75 million that would have taken them to the $225 million cap. And their EBITDA margins were more like over 59% as opposed to 35%. So this deal, it ended up being that we paid, I think, about 3.7 times 2020 EBITDA for Ilera, which has been obviously a great multiple to pay. But it's even better than that because we owned it since the summer of 19, and it built over $30 million in cash over that time period. And we got to use that $30 million towards that final payment. So it was actually, we actually paid even less than 3.7 times, which actually, you know, now that I think about it, I remember when we announced that deal, I had several other multi-state operator CEOs that told me that they thought that we overpaid for this deal and that it was, I was going to artificially or somehow set the precedent and prices for other deals, that I was like screwing things up. And it ended up obviously that I think they just didn't understand the structure or what we were buying and what a good asset we were buying, because it ended up being, you know, probably one of the least expensive deals I've ever done, or certainly the best based upon, you know, the quality of the asset. And that made me realize, I think that, you know, you really, I mean, I've always known this in terms of stock picking. I really don't care what other people think about what I mean, I want to hear opinions from people whose opinions I value and who have good insights. But generally, I can't structure my portfolio to make other people happy. Because if you end up doing that, it's almost like you're running your portfolio by committee. And that's the best way to not have really good market beating returns. So, you know, I think I realized the same thing about deals. It's like, you know, don't judge me, or maybe withhold your judgment on it now and wait a couple of years and we can look back and you'll tell me whether you thought it was a good deal. Or really, to tell you the truth, I don't really care what you think. Like I know that that's going to be my judgment 2, 3 years, 4 years out of whether it was a good deal. It's going to be based upon that, not what people think when we first announce it.
Yeah. So, you know, I hear those margins, and, you know, I guess that one of the common pushbacks on the cannabis space is, well, can't anybody enter it? How are they competing against the illicit market? Do you want to sort of frame what a license enables? Like, let's take New Jersey, for example. What does a license enable your company to do, and why are the gross margins what they are sort of structurally, if you don't mind describing that a bit?
Sure, absolutely. So what happened, what ended up leading, I mean, New Jersey we applied for ourselves, but say even Pennsylvania. What happened was, when we originally wanted to get into the U.S., all the revenue in the U.S., or most of it, was out west, right? You know, California was the biggest market in the world, and you know, that was sort of where we went first. But then, say in the first half of 19, I started, on the fund side, I started seeing all these companies that were coming in to see me that were operating in these limited license East Coast markets. And these companies were like printing money compared to the companies that I was meeting on the West Coast, where it's unlimited license. It's sort of like, you know, it's almost like getting a driver's license. You just have to qualify. And it makes sense, because the West Coast markets already had a major cannabis economy, and legalization was an attempt to bring them all into the fold in this legal framework, so they couldn't be exclusionary. Yeah. But on the East Coast, there really wasn't a cannabis economy other than, you know, maybe some drug dealers that were like buying weed on the West Coast and bringing it to the East Coast and selling it to people. So they could sort of start with a clean slate, and they wanted it to be very, you know, to have it have less licenses. It's easier to regulate it that way. And also, the state government is your partner, essentially, through the tax dollars. So they don't want this big imbalance where there's a lot more supply than there is demand, because it's going to end up, you know, hurting their economics as well. So around the first half of 19, I realized all this money was being made on the East Coast, and that was, you know, what made us gravitate towards the Ilera deal and a couple of other ones that we were working on. And it just comes down to there just being a lot less competitors. Therefore, pricing is, you know, your pricing is better. And also, on the East Coast, you pretty much have to mostly be fully vertically integrated. So you're going to be able to capture a lot more margin if you're, you know, if you're essentially, if it's seed to sale. Right? That's really the main reason. I had looked at it back to my specialty pharma days and following all the generic drug companies. It was always much more attractive to invest in a company that had a generic drug filing against a, say, $100 million drug. If they were the only filer, or there were like only two generic filers and potential competitors on a $100 million product, I had realized over the years that you would make a lot more money than if you were one of 30 generics filed against a $3 billion product. And that's sort of what I looked at California as. It was this big revenue number, but there was so much competition that there was actually less profit dollars available than there were on the East Coast with lower total revenue numbers, even though much higher growth rates, but just so many less competitors that you can really capture those 50%+ EBITDA margins. So that's sort of the big driver. And like I just said, the growth rate on the East Coast is so much more than the West Coast, just because it's so much more of an immature market. The other thing that I learned from having met with a lot of these East Coast companies is that the ones that did the best were the ones that had a deep footprint and had a lot of scale in terms of their cultivation and manufacturing. It was like amazing to me, like the less states an operator was in, the better their margins were. And also I realized, I sort of joke internally for the last couple of years, I had this motto, I would say, you have to go big early. Like if you go into some of these less mature states on the East Coast, if you go in there and you build one of the biggest facilities in the state, you're going to have the best margins, and you're going to, in the near term, and then over the long term, if and when pricing gets more competitive, if you have the most scale, there might be a price at which that it goes down to, at which a smaller, say a 30,000 square foot grow won't be able to turn a profit anymore, but 150,000 square foot grow can still make a good margin. So that was sort of my view on, sort of going big early and really being more focused. We didn't want to have flags all over the map and say we're in 20 states, because if you're in 20 states and you're competing with another operator that's in one state or two or three, there's no way that 20 state company can have the same bandwidth and have the same chance to succeed as somebody else that's more focused. I mean, Trulieve is a great example of a company that's been very focused, and that's why they were so dominant, or they still are so dominant in Florida. So that whole approach to me, we wanted to be deep, maybe a little more wide than say a Trulieve, being two or three states, and then add additional ones very slowly as we felt like those operations were really humming, because I just felt like if we did that, we'd have the best chance of winning. Because we were more focused, we were going to build more scale wherever we were. So we were going to have the best margins now. And over the long term, like I said, if prices came in, we would still have the best margins, and it would just give us the best ability over the long term to compete. I mean, my view was like an operator, and I've seen a lot of other MSOs that are the other side of the coin here. But if you're an operator you can make so much more money having 200,000 square feet in one state than having 40,000 square feet in five states. Yeah. I mean, there's no comparison. That 40,000 square feet in five states, I would say you probably cannot even turn a profit. And 200,000 in one, you can make 50%+ EBITDA margins.
Well, something that I like about your strategy is, I mean, when you're talking, I'm just hearing local economies of scale, like it ringing in my head. And then the other thing that I like is that you're almost, you are focused on the East Coast. So you turn a local economy of scale into a regional economy of scale and just sort of build it out through that and keep going. So how do you think through, like, if you have fewer competitors and you can price higher, isn't there an umbrella that the illicit market can capture? Like, where does the illicit market come into this? Because I think like one common pushback is, well, anyone can grow weed, right? And like you can't, booze is different, right? Nobody's drinking really like homemade alcohol, but weed is different. How do you kind of think through that as it morphs going forward?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that it's not like the prices, I don't believe the prices are so much higher on the East Coast than they are in, say, California. It's just that there's more people in California with their hand, in the till, because it's harder to be fully vertically integrated there, because there are tons of great growers, great cultivators, and there's companies that are great at making vapes and doing extraction. There's edibles companies. So it's just, it's not necessarily that the price is so much lower in California. It's just that there's too many people with their hand in there trying to take a piece of it. California happens to just be an expensive place to operate overall. And that's probably why partly the products are still not cheaper out there than they are, say, in New Jersey or Pennsylvania. So I think that's really been, it's real. And the other thing is like the West Coast, those operators are really sophisticated. They've been doing this for a very long time, right? And it's sort of like, not that there aren't strong competitors on the East Coast, but there's less strong competitors on the East Coast. And I sort of joked that because we have our West Coast presence and we have, you know, some sophisticated brands and sophisticated operators out there, we also own a super premium flower cultivation brand and facility out in San Francisco called the State Flower, which we just quintupled the capacity of, and we own an edibles brand, Valhalla. So since we have these great growers and retailers and out in California, we could take that and take some of those formulations and brands and know-how to the East Coast. And I felt like it was like we were playing in the pros out on the West Coast, and now we're coming to the East Coast and we're playing against like the junior high team or something like that. Or just like, you know, or maybe a team that's only got, you know, a basketball team that's got three players or something. I'm not
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's right. We'll say it nicer. We'll say it's just a private school or something that's drawing from fewer people, right? So there's fewer and less competition, if that
yes,
makes sense.
Exactly.
So let's play it forward and say, okay, well, eventually this is all going to be federally legalized. Why doesn't California or one of these states that has like great soil just dominate growing? And would that then create an impediment to your margin structure? Like, would that start to create less vertical integration on a go forward, you know, like perpetual basis?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I didn't answer your question on the illicit market, so I'll come back to that.
We'll come back to it. We're just going in the conversation.
Right. Yeah, so interstate commerce, I think a lot of people or most people think that it will eventually come. I think most people think, or my view is, it's not going to come for 3 to 5 years. But if that happens, then that also means that we have something closer to full legalization. We will have where all the companies that are currently operating will be allowed to list on the U.S. exchanges. And you will have companies that are currently listed on U.S. exchanges that can buy their way into the space. So my view is that when that all happens, it's going to be less fun than it is right now, because I sort of feel like, you know, we're like the adults in the room in terms of TerrAscend. I feel like we're one of the acquirers of choice by a lot of the targets, just because they think that we're legit and have a decent track record and have my, you know, fund, which at this point is a little under $2 billion, sort of backing it, which is nice to have. And these companies realize that the value of that. So I think that if we do get interstate commerce, like you mentioned, at least in between now and there, we'll all get paid in terms of the value of these companies should go up a whole lot. Then the question is, you know, does it get a lot more competitive and there's less profit dollars to be made? There's a good chance that's the truth, that it will be more competitive. Like every industry always gets, you know, more competitive over time. But if you're one of the better, you know, operators, you're always figure out a way to stay ahead of that. In terms of growing and making products in California and shipping them out to the rest of the world, like is done in the produce industry and all of that, I think that could serve part of the market. I don't think it will ever be cost effective to grow high quality indoor flower in California and ship it, you know, anywhere beyond, you know, the Mississippi, because there's no cost advantage. The cost advantage of California is that if you're growing outdoors, that the conditions are close to perfect and you can grow things for a much lower price. And I could see that being done and interstate commerce really supplying a lot of lower quality outdoor product or biomass, or even turning those, manufacturing those, extracting them into vapes and edibles and things like that, and shipping those from California. But my view is high quality flower, you're gonna make your money back if you build high quality indoor warehouses on the East Coast and grow flower there. Like I said, there's not going to be any cost advantage to shipping it from the West Coast. And in fact, if you ship stuff like that from the West Coast, by the time it gets to the East Coast, the flower's not going to look like it looked like when you put it into the jar, just through all the, you know, all the motion and the shaking and all of that.
Yeah, you don't want to lose the crystals. Then it doesn't sell like it could otherwise.
Exactly. So especially on the high quality side.
Yeah.
If it's somebody that's just a new medical patient, you know, a 60-year-old guy that's coming in and using it for his arthritis or whatever it is, they're not going to notice the quality differences. And that's going to be something that could be probably supplied through interstate commerce. But the people that are the connoisseurs and really like the premium indoor flower, they're the ones that are going to notice if it's all, you know, if the buds are all, you know, broken apart and things like that. So that's sort of how I see it. I mean, I really, having people stopping, you know, not getting arrested anymore, like I want things to move as quickly as possible, because it's crazy that there's something like 40,000 people sitting in jail.
Yeah, that is such bullshit.
It's such bullshit. And that they're getting arrested every day in other states for doing the same things that we're doing you know, in the states where we're doing it. So that, you know, that I would like to change immediately. But in terms of all of the other things that we're talking about, in terms of legislation that would have full legalization, all of that, I think, you know, and you, I might have said it to you before, like my view is we will make a lot more money if all of that happens later. You know, it's sort of, you know, pay me now or pay me a lot more later, because we'll be able to continue to build our businesses, you know, TerrAscend and you know, many of the other top MSOs, continue to build the businesses without these bigger companies that can throw billions of dollars at it. And, you know, if it takes 5 years, then hopefully our business will be, you know, 5 to 10 times bigger than it is right now. The stock price should follow that. And then when we get the opportunity to uplist onto the US exchanges, we'll double or triple from a higher point as opposed to from this point. So that's sort of the way I see it. And I don't really, my view is that it's not going to happen this year. It's going to be very tough for it to happen in the next year or so anyway, because, you know, Schumer is now, and most of the Democrats are more focused on the social justice aspect of legalization than they are about letting some MSOs pay less 280E taxes and things like that. Even though that does impact, maybe it even more impacts the smaller businesses, many minority owned, that are operating on a legal level, on the state level, they're getting hit by 280E too. But I think Schumer and the other Democrats, they want to prioritize the social justice aspects of it. And the problem is, this is a razor, if they were going to get anything done, it's going to be a razor thin margin anyway. And if you have, the fact is, most Republicans do not like social justice. So if you add however many Republicans you thought you were going to get to come over your side, a lot less of them are going to come over if there's a major social justice component to it. That's why I think it's just going to be too hard to get it all done. But you know what? Take whatever I said there with a grain of salt, because like predicting what's going to happen from a legislative perspective, yeah, I've practically never been right. And often you can be right and still not make money on it.
Yeah, that's fair. So there's a couple things that I want to circle back to. I think the question that's coming up in my head is, you had mentioned that some of the lower quality flower goes into edibles. Is that part of why edibles are hit and miss? Like, I have found, friends tell me, no, I'm kidding, I enjoy weed, that like edible...
We don't want to perpetuate the stigma. You have to, you're right, exactly.
No, friends, man, I did a 420 episode. I'm an advocate. So, like, edibles, I do think that it's hard to, I don't want to say predict what the experience is going to be, but it's not as predictable as flower. Is that because of the quality of cannabis that's going into the edible?
I don't think so. Okay. Any cannabis that goes into an edible has to be run through extraction first anyway. It should be of similar quality to, you know, vape pens, whether they use distillate or something else. I think that the reason, and I have the same experience myself, it just affects you. If it affects people differently, because it's being absorbed, it's being taken orally, it gets broken down by your liver. It's got a longer time for it to kick in. That's why a lot of people feel like they're not feeling anything and then take another one and then they're freaking out, you know.
Yeah, that's a bad train to get on. That train doesn't stop.
Yes. Yeah, totally. Totally. And you know what? It just, for me personally, and it sounds like, you know, and I know for a lot of people, and it sounds like for you too, it just makes me feel different. It's because it hasn't been absorbed through the lungs. You know, absorbing it through the lungs, that's the quickest way to have the effect. It also, the effect goes away the quickest, yeah, which is good. It gives you a bigger margin for error if you do consume and you're not feeling so great as opposed to edibles. But it also, just for most people I talk to, it just has a different effect on them because it's being processed through the liver. But a lot of people, there's obviously a huge market. I find that a lot of people like to take edibles for sleep.
Yeah.
When I take edibles, it's crazy. I feel it the next day.
Hmm.
I can smoke or use a vape and all I want, and the next day I don't feel any hangover effects. But if I take an edible, I actually have often like visual disturbances where things look weird. You know, I don't want to say I'm hallucinating, but it has a completely different effect on me.
Huh. I've found that you can eat your way out of smoking too much, but once the edible train leaves the station, it's you're just on the ride.
That's funny. That's funny. You know what somebody told me, and I don't know if it's true or not, that CBD, if you're having a tough time because you consume too much THC, that CBD, if you take that or you smoke that, that it knocks the THC off of your cannabinoid receptor and will actually bring you down.
Huh.
But that's...
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Smoke more to get rid of smoking too much.
Right.
Just a different thing.
Yeah.
So do you think... I've heard you bearish on the idea of branded drinks. I happen... Part of the reason that I believe in brands is what we were just talking about. There are certain edibles I used to buy in Illinois when I lived there. So shout out to Green Thumb for providing me. You know, there were a couple brands, PTS, I thought did a pretty good job. There's a couple more. But do you think, is there a reason that you're sort of less enthusiastic about drinks versus edibles and flower? Or am I not even characterizing your position correctly?
Yeah, I wouldn't say, I mean, I'm less bullish on it than I am on other form factors, just because it's such a small percentage of the pie right now. I think drinks are like 1 or 2%. And I personally... I know that people are thinking about it as opposed to drinking a beer or having a cocktail or something like that, but maybe it's more of a personal thing for me. I don't find that cannabis is a social lubricant for me the way that alcohol is. Like, I don't necessarily want to go out in a bar. You know, thank God we're finally going to be able to start going out and having normal lives again, hopefully. But I don't necessarily want to go out in a bar and be
stoned
under the influence of cannabis. It doesn't make me more social. If I consume cannabis, I want to be in a more controlled setting with the people that I'm like close with, or even more so maybe in nature or doing something else or being creative. So I don't think that it has the same appeal as going out and, you know, drinking a Budweiser or something like that. And the other thing is, I feel like I want the market to a certain extent. I want to let the market tell me what people want. And right now, if it's 1 to 2% of the total of, you know, of all the dollars spent on cannabis, I just feel like there's better places to focus. I mean, 45 or 50% of people want flower.
Yeah.
When you grow really high quality flower and you're known for that, your sales are even skewed to be, you know, well over 50% flower. Yeah. And, you know, and as we just discussed, I think it's also more protected against interstate commerce over the long term. So I'd rather focus on the bigger pieces of the pie right now than the smaller ones. And I'd rather, there's lots of other companies that are out there developing these products and sort of proving them out and spending money marketing them. GTI just licensed, I think, the Can Beverage, C-A-N-N, which I think is a California-based company. I'd rather not have my opinions influence me too much. I'd rather look at the data. And if the drinks start taking off, then there'll be a way to get in there. It's not
You can acquire a brand.
Yeah, it's not that hard to develop it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'll push back just a little on you, but I do think you're right. But I could see a scenario where you have like cannabis lounges, you know, where you have like a sativa or a hybrid drink that you mix with club soda or something like that. I could see that, but I agree with you. I mean, it's not like you're going to go to, you know, the Strip in Miami or whatever and go sip on a cannabis drink. That probably, I mean, maybe some people will, but I think mass adoption of that is probably a little bit of a longer shot.
Yeah, I think that's right. But even in the, because, you know, there are consumption lounges around the country, you know, San Francisco, there's a few of the dispensaries have consumption lounges. But even there, you're not there for more than a couple of hours.
Yeah.
So why take, you know, back to the conversation about ingestibles, why take something that is going to take longer to have an effect? Like, if I was going to do that, I'd rather use a vape or smoke flower
right.
or something like that.
Yeah, that way you sort of ramp into the experience quickly.
Right, right. And if you're not into it, then you're out of it quicker as well.
That's right. And then you can stop it. Yeah, that's fair.
Right.
So is brand how you think that the illicit market is going to get sort of like fought? Is that a reasonable characterization? Right, because that's what people say to me. They're like, well, look at the illicit market and why don't people just keep buying there? For me personally, it's because I'm not going to risk my family to go buy some weed off some drug dealer. I'd rather just go to Trulieve.
Absolutely. I think it's that. I think it is also that, you know, personally, my view is like, I sort of cringe when I think of all of the, especially back in college, you know, all of the illicit market product that I consume, because I know now how stringent these state level programs are in terms of what you're allowed to use on the products when you're growing them and how hard it is. And I know that the illicit market growers are not following the same rules that the legal market growers are following. Therefore, it's just, to me, it's more of a safety thing. Like, who knows what's on that product? It hasn't been tested. It's probably more likely to have something that wouldn't be allowed in the legal market. And it also is not tested, and it's not tested for anything pretty much. So to me, that's the argument that I often use when people say, well, you know, why should I buy legal stuff over illicit market stuff? And I think, you know, we're clearly see, you know, and that's really the competition. Like to me, I don't even look at most of these other MSOs as Safer TerraSend as competitors to them, because there's a huge opportunity out there that's available. It's not a zero sum game. And it's really the illicit market still owns the majority of the market. I think that's really the competition. And we are seeing every year there's more sales that come from, that move from the illicit market to the legal market. And also now that, you know, over the last few years, we've been bringing so many new patients and consumers into the market. And those are people, you know, say my, 68-year-old grandmother, she's not going to be comfortable. She's going to be one of the more sort of newer users. Yeah. She's not going to be comfortable buying.
Calling up some random guy.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's going to come deliver it to her door or something. So I think that it's a, the legal market, I think, is definitely more appealing to the newer, less experienced consumers as well. But it's, but it's appealing to me too, because why should I, if I can get something, it's like, would you buy Tylenol that was like made in somebody's bathtub if you needed it? Yeah, or would you know, would you choose, the J&J product?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the difference between those two things is people are used to consuming the stuff just off the street, but
it's true.
I mean, you know, there is a real difference in quality that I've seen from the stuff that you can buy at the store versus, like, you know, I remember in college, if I could get stuff that was half as good as what you can just walk in and buy at a store now, I'd be like, oh my God, I'm buying from this guy all the time, right? But, and there was no consistency. So I do think that the store adds a level of, I guess, comfort and certainty would be how I would characterize the two things.
Yes, I think I definitely agree with that. And you don't have to worry about getting shorted if you know, like back in the day.
Yeah, that's right. I don't
like,
have to have my own scale and be like, this asshole sold me oregano.
Yeah, right, exactly. You don't have to, you know, now it's, you know, whatever it says on the jar, you're essentially getting it. And, so that's another thing. To me, there's no reason to buy stuff from the illicit market anyway, you know, at this point. And the thing is, a lot of it is actually grown, but, you know, there's a lot of California operators that operate in the legal market, and then they're selling the stuff that doesn't necessarily pass their testing. They're selling that stuff out the back door. And that's what ends up working its way out to New York or to the East Coast and things like that. So either way, you know, it's either grown in a place with methods that are not as safe, or it was grown in a legal place and it's the stuff that's not as good.
Huh. That's interesting. How do you think through, like, to me, the relationship with the consumer exists at the retail level and with the bud tender in many instances? You had mentioned like the social justice component. Is there a push to get more licenses in minority-owned businesses' hands? And like, how do you as an incumbent protect yourself from losing that relationship on a go-forward basis? Or alternatively, is the relationship with the regulator so good that it's probably going to be protected to a certain extent anyway?
I mean, I think there's going to be both, you know, a lot of the, especially now on the East Coast, the New York law and, you know, what's happening in Jersey and other places, there are licenses set aside for minority, you know, social equity applicants. And then you have the other ones that are set aside just for for-profit, you know, operators. I mean, they're both for-profit, you know, the minority.
Yeah. But some is specifically carved aside to remedy a wrong that was done in the past. And some is just a flat-out apply and see how you get a license.
Yes, exactly. So I think that there's room for both. This might be a good time to bring up this impact fund that I started with Chris Weber to actually fund social equity applicants and just businesses run by people of color, because my view is, well, the fact is that four times as many black people are getting arrested every single day than white people, and they're not four times the users versus white people. And that coupled with the fact that I think only 3% of the state level legal licenses right now are owned by people of color. So they're underrepresented in terms of ownership. They're overrepresented, unfortunately, in terms of, you know, being incarcerated.
Incarceration, yeah.
Yeah. And to me, if we don't even that out a little bit and get at least get the ownership levels up closer to what their normal percentage is of the consumers and all of that, then this whole industry is going to have been built on a foundation that was, you know, that had cracks in it. It's going to almost be like, how can we say that we righted any of the wrongs over the years, for the last 50 years of all how these laws were essentially used as weapons against people of color? How can we say that we've righted any of that if we end up having a legal industry that's 3% owned by people of color?
Be some real bullshit. If you study some of the history, my understanding is that a lot of people of color back in like the early 1900s really kind of couldn't afford alcohol for reasons that, you know, price reasons. And then like it almost became this propaganda machine where it was like, oh, well, if you smoke weed, you're like, you know, black people or whatever. And then it got, you know, scary to whatever. It was all just like a marketing propaganda thing. Yeah, that's right. And then if the outcome of all of this is a whole bunch of white people owning everything, that would be like way fucked up. I didn't mean to laugh when I said it, but like that would be offensive in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, like that they did win the war on drugs, that sort of all the racists won because they locked everybody up, so many people up in jail for over so many years, and also caused them to not be able to have the level of ownership that they should have in the industry. So therefore, I think we do need to have these programs on the state level. I don't think that they are major threats to all of the other multi-state operators. And if some of these, and I hope that many of these black-owned businesses do go on to be very successful and go into multiple states and all of that. But to me, it's a bigger threat to not have the industry look more like what the consumers of cannabis look like. It can't just be, you know, 98% white people owning these businesses. And the other thing is, in terms of the reason we started the fund, is this business is hard no matter what color you are. This is a really, really difficult industry because there's so many hoops you have to jump through about every little thing that if you were starting an accounting firm or something like that, you wouldn't be dealing with it. And there's so few people, there's such a shortage of even people with experience in the space because it's been, you know, a legal industry for such a short period of time. If I was starting an accounting firm or a drug company, I can go.
Yeah, there's plenty of mentorship out there, right?
Yeah, there's plenty of people. You know, I can find accountants that have been doing this for 30 years. If I go and I want to start a cannabis business and I find somebody that's got, you know, 30 years of experience in this business, like they're even more willing to take risks than I am and that most people are right now.
Yeah.
So you really can't, you don't have a ton of experienced people. It's hard to bank. It's hard to, you know, like half of the service providers won't do business with you. So that's if you're well-financed and you can go to the capital markets and all of that. It's even harder if some of these companies that we're going to be looking to fund, if they don't have that access to the capital markets and they don't have the experience that unfortunately now I've got, you know, a lot of scars from mistakes that I've made in the past that I'm not going to make going forward. Chris and my view is that let's help fund these companies, but let's also give them the benefit of the experience that I've had and having them not make the same mistakes that I had. You know, I'm sure we'll make new mistakes there, but at least we won't make the same dumb mistakes that ended up costing us a lot over time. So we really want to, we're not looking to just, you know, you hear this a lot, like in private equity, that we're not looking to just write a check, that we're going to be there to support and help make the business better. I hope that based upon my track record with my other companies that people see that, like, we really do that. We don't just say it. And we need to make sure that this fund is successful and that we invest in companies that are going to be sustainable, profitable companies over time, because we want to do more of this. And if we can't, you know, we are going to prove out the business model, because if we can't, then we're not going to be able to sustain this and go out and do a $300 million fund the next time. So that's what Chris and I are totally and completely aligned on this. And we feel like the stakes are high because there's a lot riding and we feel like we can have a real impact on these communities. In the past, a lot of these social equity applicants, it was just like a payday for one or two people that were on the application. We want to be able to help build real businesses by social equity applicants so that they can have a positive impact on their community and use that, you know, that there's lots of people in the community that are part of what's being done there. And then that's sort of a multiplier and sends more people to college and ends up spawning even more businesses from out of those communities.
Yeah, man, that's cool. I've heard you talk about it now twice, and I like the passion that I hear in your voice when you talk about it. And it seems, I mean, I don't know Chris, obviously, but he seems like a cool dude. It's nice to see somebody get in the space for the right reasons and use their fame and fortune to help people that really could use a lot of help.
Yeah, he's got a
great heart. I'm going to let you go, but I got to ask one question to help people with the research. You know, when I look at you had issued some equity, and from the outside, I think you could say, okay, well, here's a guy that has a fund that's long cannabis, says he sees it in the early innings. Why issue equity when it's presumably cheap to raise funds? So maybe giving people a sense of how you were thinking and some of the capital constraints that are on you as a function of the industry might give some good background.
Sure, absolutely. So it's a lot harder to borrow money at attractive rates because it's an illegal industry. So rates are more like all in with paying points up front and different things. You know, rates are still in the, you know, probably in the 12-ish, 13-ish percent at that level if you want to borrow money. So that option is a little less attractive versus thinking about raising equity. And also, I've just learned over the years from investing in companies that it's always safer to raise equity than it is to raise too much debt. Because if you have a lot of debt and you have a bad quarter, you could be out of business. If you don't have a lot of debt and you have a bad quarter, you just had a bad quarter, you know?
yeah, that's right.
So it's just, you know, like it just makes it a lot tougher. So that's one reason to raise equity versus some other alternatives. The other thing is, this is a very expensive business to be in. These facilities, you want to build a nice facility, it's going to cost you over $30 million. And 280E tax, which I mentioned earlier, it's really like it kills your cash flow. So yeah. You end up having to raise more money just to very often fund a lot of that because less of it falls back to the bottom line. What happened in January was we had raised some debt in December, so we didn't really need to raise any more money, but we figured, well, we'll go in and raise $50 million just to sort of give us some optionality, look at some more deals, help, you know, maybe we do some bigger expansions in some of the states where we already are. And we just felt like it would be, you know, and it was because over the prior year, it was the capital markets were so constrained and it was so tough that this was post the election in January where the Democrats picked up those seats and all of a sudden there were a lot more new investors that were calling us up that were very interested. So we decided to go out and raise 50. We were going to bring a few companies, a few firms over the wall so we can get an indication of how much they might want. And we were going to, on Monday, the next week, we were going to announce, you know, we're raising 50 and we've already got 25 or 30, you know, circled and we're open on the rest. And what happened was, I mean, that's when I realized that things had really changed for the better in terms of new investors. We went out to raise 50 and we made four or five phone calls, and we had almost $200 million in orders.
Yeah, a little oversubscribed, huh?
Yeah, just a little bit. And then the conversation was, you know, internally, what do we take? My thought was, I don't want to be like one of these kids in the Depression that like is always still thinking like they don't have any money and therefore, like, should we really take it all when we don't need it because we're thinking of how we felt a year ago, right?
Yeah.
But we talked through it all and really, because as I said, it's an expensive business. If you want to do CapEx or you want to do acquisitions, having a better balance sheet certainly puts you in a much stronger position. And we decided, we ended up doing that 175. And, you know, the fact is there's so many really good deals out there that can really sort of even supercharge the profitability that we have now. And if some portion of whatever deal you're negotiating is, if some portion of it is cash, it gets you so much more, you get so much more value for it than you would if you used equity. So we just felt like, let's, you know, we'll be able to sleep a little bit better at night knowing that we have a, you know, fortress-like balance sheet, and it will help get us better deals and just help us accelerate the build-outs and maybe get them done a little bit quicker. To me, in these undersupplied markets, the sooner you bring those facilities online where there's less competition out there, we're in the process of adding a good amount of capacity to Pennsylvania again. The math, when you're adding to an existing facility that already has the drying rooms and the break rooms and all of that, the math on adding that additional flower space, you wouldn't believe the payback. It's like less than like, you know, 7 or 8 months.
Yeah. I was talking to a guy that's converting some stuff in Las Vegas to Bobby Flay restaurants. He works for that entity. And he was like, the cash on cash is crazy with the incremental. And as you were talking, I was like, yep, I think I understand what Jason's saying here. So I dig. I know you hit your time limit, man, so I'll let you get out of here, but we're going to call this part one and know that you can come over on the pod anytime. It's been fun getting to know you, and I look forward to future conversations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Looking forward to part two.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Jason Wild.